What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the show. We're going to do a Q&A today. Let's see how many of these we can get done in 33 minutes. You guys have been amazing with questions lately. I really, really appreciate that. It makes it super fun to do these podcasts and also, you know, get some of these done on Instagram. So for that, I thank you. I have not seen any of these questions. We're just going to go through whatever comes up for the next 33 minutes, and then we'll get you out of here. I have my friend Brian coming on tomorrow just to get a download of what he's been up to. He's been doing some fun stuff with his training, and I'd like to hear about it. And we'll kind of chit-chat about some hypertrophy and cardio stuff, as we always do. So first question, let's get into it. What do you think is more important for building muscle? More volume or more intensity? Yeah, neither. You need enough of both, right? If either of these went to zero, you'd build no muscle, right? So if you did no volume, like no sets, you'd build no muscle. If your sets were all crazy far from failure because you had no intensity, you'd build no muscle. And all of these are on a curve of diminishing returns. So in order to answer this question, I'd have to know where you are on that curve, right? So if you're doing, you know, can you imagine if you just close your eyes, imagine what diminishing returns look like on a graph where it starts out like there's a steep increase with each additional unit of whatever you're talking about, so volume or intensity, and then with each additional unit of benefit, it starts to level off. And so if you're at the very, like if you're doing 20 sets per muscle group per week and they're all 5 reps in reserve, then more intensity would be more important because you're already doing the volume thing. If you're doing 1 set per muscle group per week and it's all out to failure, well then for you, doing more sets or more volume would be more beneficial. So this is an impossible question without knowing where you're at. And you know, this question can get near impossible to answer once you're doing both of these things reasonably well. So if you're doing, something like 3 to 8 direct sets per muscle group per week within 2 reps in reserve, so pretty dang hard, it's kind of hard to say, you know, going even closer to failure when you're already pretty close and doing even more volume when you're already doing sufficient, both of them will lead to diminishing returns. The thing is, I'd say intensity has a bit more of a cap, right? You can, I guess you could train to failure and then you could add a bunch of myo reps, but myo reps is adding more volume. It's not necessarily adding more intensity, right? You could do forced eccentrics or partial reps, but even those have more of a final point to them. Like you could, in theory, on paper, not in reality, but on paper, keep adding sets. So you need enough of both. You know, I'd say, you know, 3 to 8 direct sets per muscle group per week. You know, you could say, I 4 to 10 also makes sense depending on how hard you're training, where you are in your training, what exercises, et cetera. So yeah, you need enough sets and you need enough intensity. So if whichever one you're doing less of and you have more runway to add more productive work in terms of more sets or closer to failure, that's the one that's more important for you. Next question. How much cardio do you recommend in a week for someone training for hypertrophy? What cardio do you recommend with minimal interference effects? So if your only goal is hypertrophy, you don't need much cardio. I mean, there you could say, hey, if you were in better cardiovascular shape, maybe you'd be able to recover from more work and you could do more work and then you could further maximize muscle growth. But we are so crazy in the margins there. So if you're like, hey, I just want to be jacked and look muscular and lean, like you don't need any formal cardio at all. I'll get to like a more helpful answer, but that's answering your question directly. How much cardio do I recommend for someone training for hypertrophy? None, you know, like I recommend you do it because generally I would never tell someone that they should do no cardio, right? Because for overall health and longevity, improving your cardiovascular fitness is maybe the most important single thing you can do. So someone training for hypertrophy, what I would tell that person is, hey, you should be training for hypertrophy and for longevity, so you should do some freaking cardio. But like, again, if you're like, my only goal in life is to get jacked, how much cardio do I need to do? None. You could just walk and modulate your diet and lift weights and you would do just fine. What cardio do you recommend with minimal interference effects? The most important thing is to just not do too much work or more work than you can recover from on a cumulative basis. I know that's an annoying answer, but you could do, you know, a moderate intensity, high intensity cardio, and it wouldn't interfere if you were doing the right amount of it. So do I think generally lower intensity cardio is a less risky thing. What, again, I don't think any of this is risky, but is lower intensity cardio less likely to make you, like, what is the interference effect? The interference effect has nothing to do with, like, physiological pathways, growth pathways, AMPK pathway, mTOR. It doesn't have to do with that. It has to do with, am I so tired from all the training that I'm doing that I can't make progress, right? Like, cardio interferes with your ability to lift weights if the cardio you're doing makes you so tired that when you show up for your lifting session, you can't perform well enough, elicit that sort of an adaptation to keep getting better. And that's not just acutely. It's not like, oh, the cardio I did this morning affected my lift later. It's a chronic thing. It's like across the week, am I just so run down from everything that I'm doing that I'm unable to perform well enough to progress? That's what the interference effect is. So the answer is, what cardio do I recommend to minimize that? Not too much cardio. Generally speaking, it's easier for people to overdo higher intensity cardio. It's harder for people to overdo lower intensity cardio. So if my fear is that somebody would overdo it, I guess I'd lean closer towards the lower intensity zone 2 work. But for overall health, I think a mix of intensities is probably best. So, you know, over the long term, I'd love to get somebody on a schedule where they occasionally get their heart rate up, so to speak. Next question. In a deficit for a few years and losing weight, is it okay that weights have stayed the same in workouts, or should we push to increase? Well, first of all, you've been in deficit for a few years. I kind of want to unpack that. I don't know if we can unpack this here in a one-sided conversation, but I would be interested in how that's gone and how you feel. But technically speaking, technically on paper, there's nothing wrong with that because time doesn't really matter. Time is not a variable per se. I mean, it's a variable practically, but not technically. But okay, your question. Is it okay that weights have stayed the same? Here's the deal. If you have maintained your strength, maintained it, and you've been losing weight for the last few years and you've lost no strength, that's incredible. Do I think that there's also a world where if you were training adequately, you should have gotten stronger over this process, over this period of time? Yes, I do. But like very generally, if someone stops me on the street and they're like, hey, I just lost a bunch of fat over the last year and I didn't get any weaker, I maintained all my muscle, I'd be stoked for that person. So again, do I think like with good training and enough protein and the intent to progress, which is part of your question here, do I think you could have made some progress? Probably. But again, if somebody hands you, if you're like meeting with the deficit gods and you sit down before your deficit and they hand you over a paper and they're like, you're not going to gain any muscle, you're not going to lose any muscle over this time, and they slide the paper over to you, like, you sign that paper. You know what I mean? Like, you sign that paper. Because it just isn't a big deal. Like, the amount of muscle you could gain in the deficit, like, it's just not a lot. You could gain some, maybe, in an ideal scenario. But if you just don't lose any, like, that's awesome. That's a really great outcome. So, yeah, if you haven't lost any muscle, I'm stoked for you. However, your question is, or should we push to increase? I mean, generally, trying to get stronger and build muscle over time is a good idea. Especially because the older we get, we are fighting against an accelerated rate of, you know, degradation and inactivity and atrophy and all that stuff. And so the pursuit to progress is probably what's required for long-term health or long-term, let's say long-term getting all of the benefits of strength and physical function. I think some element of the intent to get better, the intent to progress is, I don't want to say required, but highly advised. Next question, how much benefit is there in structured intervals as compared to just pushing harder for some portions of a run, in parentheses, fartlek style? So fartlek is Swedish for, sounds funny in English, but it's Swedish for speed play. And there are, depending on who you ask, a lot of definitions of what a fartlek is. But, you know, very, very loose guideline of what a fartlek is go out for a run, kind of easy. And during periods of that run, push harder. And during that push, if you start to feel tired, slow down. And then when you start to feel good again, push hard. And then when you start to feel tired, slow down. And, you know, so on and so on. So a fartlek style, I mean, it sounds like something a professional runner wouldn't do. It sounds like a professional runner would be more structured. That's not true. Fartleks are used widely by high-level endurance athletes. I'd say they probably add some structure to it where it's like, hey, you need to you go out for an hour run and during that hour you need to complete 10 by 2 minutes surge. But after each surge, you can cool off until you feel ready for the next one. So it's kind of like a structured interval session, but with an auto-regulated rest periods, and sometimes an auto-regulated work interval, right? My coach and I use terminology like upper fartlek and lower fartlek, depending on which one of those two things you are kind of auto-regulating. So to your question, how much benefit is there? I think it depends what else you're doing, right? I think if you have other sessions that are like there, if your goal is to pick a very specific pace and be elite at it or be your best at it or get better at it, you're going to need a little bit of specificity around that, right? If you want to run your best 5K, like we're going to have a little bit more structure around some sessions. You can't get away from that, right? We need some specific race pace practice. We need some specific maybe over race pace interval work. But do I think fartleks can get you to a very fit level? Absolutely. I absolutely love programming fartleks. I think just giving the athlete the chance to auto-regulate a little bit and say, hey, you know what? Just go out for 45 minutes and give me 5 1-minute surges and then rest as long as you want in between them. Just got to get those 5 done over the course of the 45 minutes. I think it's a wonderful thing. It's not just physiologically, it can be a good workout, but it's also psychologically for the athlete to have a bit of unstructured work is very nice. So I really like it. You know, I think how much benefit is there in structured intervals? It depends what your goal is. You know, if you're trying to be elite at a specific distance, you can't just kind of get out there and go by vibes and get your way to your best effort, or your best level of performance. But yeah, fartleks are going to be part of every good running program at some point. Next question. If my protein, fiber, and calories are in check, does it matter how I split up my carbs and fats? I much prefer carbs over fat. The short answer is no. The long answer is, you know, so the short answer is no. And the reason that if you hit your protein and fiber and your calories are in check, the reason I don't think it matters is because most people will get enough carbs and fats without focusing on it. So there is such a thing as going too low in fat or too low in carbs, right? I mean, you know, you could say, well, too low in carbs, like don't people do fine on a ketogenic diet? They do, but even like very, very long-term people on ketogenic diets, well, I don't want to go too into anecdote narrative street, but we see people on ketogenic diets for a very long time end up saying, oh, I started to not feel very good for a long time. But then other people are on a ketogenic diet for many years and claim that everything's fine. So I'd say I'd be more inclined to, from the fat perspective. So let me give you an example. I take on a client and we don't track carbs and fats. However, within the first month or so, I'll say, hey, what have your average fats been? You know, what have your average carbs been? Let's just take a look at those. And I've been doing this for what year is it? Friggin' 2016, it's 2026, 13 years, 14 years, 12 years. And not a single time has a client intuitively under-eaten carbs or fats. Always, every single time, they have gotten at least a minimum of, let's say, 0.3 grams per pound of fat, right? So if you're 150 pounds, that would be 45 grams of fat on average, not necessarily every single day. And for carbohydrates, I honestly care a bit less unless you are doing a lot of training, unless you're doing like hybrid training. Like if you are lifting and doing some sort of endurance exercise or you're training for HYROX or CrossFit, I think being adequately fueled in terms of carbohydrates matters. That doesn't necessarily mean you need a strict target, but I would recommend keeping an eye on it. And maybe, you know, maybe what you can do is even just give yourself kind of a fat target and then assume all the rest of the calories are going to come from carbohydrates. So, you know, 0.3 to 0.5 grams per pound of fat is a good place to be for supporting good hormone production. And we can, you know, fiber and calories, et cetera. If those things are in check, I got to tell you, I'm not worried about it. It's not because there isn't a scenario where it might matter. It's just that, again, up to this date, not a single person I've ever worked with has intuitively under-eaten those macros to a point where it's been a problem. But we do check because it is possible. So hope that helped. Next question. What activity level would you classify 5 to 8 hours of highly active? What activity level would you classify 5 to 8 hours of cardio a week plus lifting 3 times a week? Highly active. Whatever the most active thing is on your calorie calculator, that is you. 5 to 8 hours of cardio a week, dude. Plus lifting 3 times a week. Are you a professional athlete? Like, yeah, that's a ton of activity, dude. So whatever activity level is the highest one that's available, that's the one I would pick. Next question. Do you think cutting bulking cycles are not necessary for average folk who are not competing? What to do instead? You know, I'm not nitpicking you, dear question asker. But just remember, when you ask a question, it's hard for me to know, like, for what, right? Like, do I think, I know you said for the average person who are not competing, is, and I appreciate that. I know you tried to add that context here, but is this a person who's not competing who is also interested in, like, you might not be competing. I work with people who are not competing, but who are very interested. I work with some people like this, who are very interested in maximizing muscle growth and maximizing the rate of physique change and body composition improvement. So if you're inferring that by saying somebody who's not competing, they're also not so worried about maximizing the rate of physique change or maximizing muscle growth, then I think it's not necessary. I think to get the health benefits of resistance training and muscle, you don't ever need to be in a surplus. 99% of people don't ever need to be in a surplus. If your only goal is health and physical function, you could do that at maintenance calories, because you could do that just by getting newbie gains. And by then you're like as strong as you'll ever need to be for daily living and longevity. There's more I'd want to unpack about that, because I talk about this a lot in my podcasts here and there, but like the point is, so that's your question kind of answered, which is you could just eat at roughly maintenance calories and lift for 2 or 3 years, and you probably have the most of, if not all of the muscle you'll need for physical function for the rest of your life if you keep doing it. However, what I said there is if you keep doing it, and I'm not going to go too deep into this. I've talked about this in previous podcasts, which is sometimes in order to continue doing something, like your goal should be to resistance train and to exercise until you die. So I'm 34. Let's say I want to be 94. That's 60 more years of exercise. Am I going to keep up with exercise for the next 60 years if I don't ever try to improve at anything? And I just kind of, I don't want to say go through the motions, but I technically go through the motions where I'm training, but I'm not training enough to get better. Will I be able to keep training? So for some people, like we need certain vehicles, motivational vehicles, goals to help us stay in the game for the next 60 years. And for some people, bulking and cutting and trying to build more muscle than you might need and trying to get more jacked than you might need for health, for some people, that is a vehicle for them to stay in it, to keep doing it for as long as they need to get what they really want, which is 60 years go by and you've been really strong that whole time. So I think the average person could eat maintenance calories enough to support their training, enough protein, lift for 3 years, and then keep lifting, but not need to bulk and maintain and gain probably a tiny bit of muscle over time. And yeah, you'd be perfectly healthy. But if you have more ambitions than that, then you should probably do some bulking and cutting. Or if bulking and cutting for you is a fun vehicle to stay emotionally engaged in the process, I get that. I have clients all the time that are like, yeah, I bulk and cut because it's fun. It's not always that it's fun, but it's like a fun, also it's a challenge sometimes. And giving myself some sort of thing that I can sink my teeth into is how I maintain emotional engagement in the process and how I stay more consistent. So I will respect both sides of that discussion. Next question. When I'm doing 60 degree overhead press, I tend to push my feet so hard on the ground that my bum lifts from the seat. Is this cheating? Cheat. I'm not coming at you, by the way. Cheating just like I don't like that word. Should you do this? No. you should not do this. Two reasons. One is it's something that's now really hard to modulate, because as weeks go by, you could just keep lifting your butt more and more and more and more and more. Not forever, but it will become how you're ultimately lifting more weight. Your delts are not getting stronger. You're just better at lifting your butt and bringing in or changing the leverage of the movement. And so it's kind of like this, you've added in this element of like non-muscle strength progression. You're like, I'm able to lift more weight week to week because I'm better at artificially changing my body position to affect leverages to lift. It's like, just keep your butt in the seat and then you know that you're progressing when your delts and triceps get stronger, right? I could have easily said, no, that's wrong technique. It's cheating. Don't do it. But like those words don't mean anything. What's really happening is that person who's lifting their butt is not getting any more delt gains. They're just progressing by nature of changing the leverages, changing their body position to lift more weight. And it's just like a waste of energy. So I would keep your butt in the seat for all pressing movements. What are your favorite and least favorite fruits and vegetables? Oh, we're going to have a little therapy session. This might take up the rest of the podcast here. If you ask me what makes up a good diet, I'll do a little therapy session. I promise I'll answer your question, but this is what you get from me, is we're going to do a little backstory and then we'll get to it. If you ask me what is a good diet, one of the first words out of my mouth is going to be dark leafy greens and other vegetables. You know, dark leafy greens, if I just rattle off the top of my mind, what's a good diet? Let's say a wide variety of minimally processed plant foods, including things like dark leafy greens, other vegetables, a wide variety of fruits and tubers and nuts and seeds and legumes and whole grains, sufficient protein, and a lot of healthy fat, not too much saturated fat. That's a healthy diet, right? However, if you look at my diet, if I look at myself, I probably don't check that dark leafy green box like I would, you know, there's a bit of do as I say, not as I do. I could probably do better with that. I don't think my life is full of spinach and arugula and chard and kale and, you know, and you know, broccoli and Brussels sprouts and asparagus, let's just say greens, you know, greens, foods higher in phytochemicals, et cetera. Phytonutrients, sorry. I guess phytochemicals, same thing, but okay. And so I could probably do better with that. I eat quite a bit of broccoli and asparagus, but I probably don't get into my like dark leafy green vibes as much. So what I do is I eat a very wide variety of fruit. And I know that that's not the same thing. It's not the same thing, right? But here's the thing I don't do well. I don't eat enough dark leafy greens for a couple of reasons, like practically. I don't want to get into it right now, but I could do better with it. And I'd like to, and it's my plan to. But I'm working on it. That's all. Being transparent, I'm working on it. One thing I do really well, though, is I eat a wide variety of fruits to make sure I'm getting a wide variety of fiber type and micronutrients, antioxidants, vitamins, minerals, all that good stuff. So to answer your question more directly, my favorite vegetables, if we're assuming what you're not talking about, like sweet potatoes and stuff like that, we're talking about like greens, asparagus and broccoli are my go-tos that I can eat. You know, listen, I like vegetables. Sorry for the rant. I love vegetables, but I love them when they're cooked well. You know, like if you, again, and some people out there is like, oh, just roast them, put a little olive oil, salt and pepper. Like, I hear you, by the way, and I love vegetables when they're roasted, a little olive oil, salt and pepper. But like, I have a 2-year-old, and like sometimes I get off my last call at 5 p.m. and I'm the one who cooks dinner. That's the job that I love doing. And sometimes like I didn't warm up the oven, and my daughter was already hungry, and so it's not always. And I'm making excuses, but that's okay. I'm admitting this is my life and how I'm living it, which is to say, sometimes I don't really have the time, the energy, the bandwidth, the will to prepare my vegetables in a way where they're more delicious. So asparagus and broccoli are two vegetables that I can buy in a frozen microwave fashion and eat no problem at all. So I try and eat quite a bit of broccoli and asparagus. I'll do vegetable mixes for sure. There's like at Costco has these frozen bags. I think it's Pura Vida, maybe. Pure life. And it's like a mixed bag of veggies that we also try and have just to get some variety in there. So that's me from a vegetable standpoint. Anything else I missed on veggies? Especially if we're talking about greens, probably not. That's where I'm at. But fruits, man, fruits have been my jam for the last couple of years, just really getting into a wide variety of fruits and fruit juices. There's a good podcast, Simon Hill podcast, about some of the research on 100% fruit juice and how you could look at the macros on a 100% fruit juice and be like, oh, it's just sugar water. But actually, like every time they look at fruit and vegetable juices, like 100% fruit and vegetable juice, we see positive outcomes. So anyway, fruit. Let me get at it. It's just like me just rambling. Fruit, I eat a ton of berries, a ton. Exclusively frozen berries. They don't need to be washed. They are cheaper. They last longer. You can buy a pre-mix. It's a no-brainer. Get on your mixed frozen berry game. I eat a lot of mixed frozen berries. I eat a lot of kiwi. I eat a lot of bananas. I eat a lot of apples. I try and get some sort of new fruit each time I go. Maybe it's a cantaloupe. Maybe it's a pineapple with watermelons in season. I eat a lot of cherries. We try and do one shake per day, which I've been need to get better at, but in that shake, we'll do like some sort of a mix, make sure there's some mango in there. What else have we had lately in the fruit category? We've had plums and peaches when they're in season. So I try and eat a wide variety of fruit. I think a wide variety of minimally processed plant foods, you know, AKA fruits and vegetables for the most part, really, really good. You know, trying to get some different colors in there. Some of those darker colored fruits, all a really, really good idea. Cool. Sorry for the long ramble on that one. Next question. Do you think your program train, your group program would be good to pair with marathon training? So I think, here's what I'll say. If you, there are some people out there who would say, you can't just take a lifting program and a running program and layer them on top of each other and do it. Now, I think there is some truth to that. I think if you took a running program, so let's say you find a marathon program, and that marathon program is not accounting for the fact that you might be lifting. They are writing that marathon program, assuming that's all the exercise that you're doing. And then you also take a lifting program that assumes that's all you're doing. Both of those programs are going to, because they're assuming that's all you're doing, they're going to have a lot of that thing. It's going to be a lot of running and a lot of lifting. But what I plan to do is I plan to have marathon programming in my app in this, let's say, the first quarter of this new year here. Except my program will be designed with you lifting in mind. So you would toggle on, I'll have like a 12-week or a 12, 16-week beginner marathon and let's say advanced marathon. And you would toggle that on. And you would toggle on a lifting program. And again, it sounds like you're doing that thing where you're like, oh, I just pick a marathon program, I pick a lifting. But this would be programs that were made with that in mind. So I think my group training program would be good enough, would be good to pair with marathon training if that marathon training has left you room to do other training. If you're doing a marathon program, it's like 60 to 80 miles a week. Yeah, you might not be able to do my programming. Now, I offer 2 times per week training and 3 times per week training and 4 times per week training. So the more running you're doing slash the less time you have overall, you could pick a 2 times per week training program. To answer your question more directly, I think the answer is yes, except I'd highly question if you're doing too much overall, and I would recommend the 2 or 3 times per week training, not the 4 times per week. I think training 4 times a week, lifting and training for a marathon, you can do it. You can totally do it. I don't think it's an insane thing that you absolutely cannot do, but that's a ton of training. So if you want to join my group program, I think it would work wonderfully with your marathon program. Assuming that marathon program is a reasonable amount of volume and assuming you pick the 2 or 3 times per week lifting program, not the 4. Again, I say that because I don't know enough about you and I'd rather give a more conservative recommendation if I'm giving this kind of just blindly here. Next question. When lifting heavy as prescribed by your program, what should you expect your heart rate to get to? None. I don't have any expectation at all. I'm not coming at your question. I see where the question is coming from, but the answer is I have no expectation. I don't care. You shouldn't care. And frankly, between me and you, you know, wrist wearable heart rate devices aren't amazing. So I wouldn't even really trust that metric that much. You know, for some people it works really well. For others, it does not. My heart rate on my watch, it's an old watch, but it's a very expensive watch. Has always been like 8 to 12 beats per minute off, which can be a lot compared to like a chest strap, let's say. So I don't care. You shouldn't care. I don't have an expectation and I wouldn't even trust the heart rate metric all that much. So, but you said my heart rate can get up there. And okay, you know, what I'm going to say is that's cool. And why am I saying that's cool? Because at least just gives me like one little tiny inkling that you're working hard in your sets. I don't think it's cool because like you said, I don't think it's a robust cardiovascular stimulus. I don't think it's cool because getting your heart rate up is the point of lifting. I think it's cool because that at least gives me one little inkling that you're working hard, and that's nice. Next question. I bought my first cookbook, but almost all the recipes are very high in sodium. The author's bio on IG claims her recipes are healthy. Another influencer on IG with a cookbook also had a recipe that was very high in sodium. I thought there was a recommended daily amount to stay under. Yeah, the recommended daily amount is 2.3 grams or 2,300 milligrams for the average adult. And of course, I think that that's every public health recommendation. Well, no, some public health recommendations will apply more because because of the way that they are applied. So, you know, the public health recommendation to keep your saturated fat below 10% of total calories, that's something that scales with body size, right? If you're a bigger person, you have more calories, but it's still under 10% calories. But to say that the RDA is, you know, 2,300 milligrams or whatever, that doesn't scale with body size. You know, I'm 200 pounds and I exercise a lot. Can I have more sodium than 120 pound sedentary person? Probably, yeah, probably. So I don't know exactly how high these recipes were in terms of sodium. I do think that you have a lot of ways. It's funny. You have a lot of ways to make something taste good, right? You can have a higher fat food, let's say, that tastes good, but it's low in, you know, carbs and sodium, and it tastes pretty good. You know, you can have foods that are made to taste good because they're a little higher in fat. You can have other meals or foods that are made to taste good because they're a little higher in carbs or sugar. And other times where you're like, wow, look at this low fat, low carb dish or whatever, but they've made it high in sodium and that's how it tastes good enough to sell. So that does happen sometimes where you see a product that's like scores really well in certain metrics. But in order to make it not taste like they need something in there that tastes good. So I do find that to happen sometimes. And sodium is one that I think it's smart marketing for these companies and even this person, because they are, you know, most people are like, oh, let's look at the macros. And then they don't really look at the sodium. And blood pressure is mega serious. It's like a super duper serious thing. And sodium, you know, eating too much sodium is in all likelihood going to increase blood pressure. I don't want to fear monger. Like if you have a salty meal that you're screwed, you're not. I just mean chronically eating too much sodium is not the best plan. Again, I don't know what the numbers were on this recipe. I don't know what size of a person you are. I don't know how much you exercise. I don't know how much other sodium you have in your diet. You know, I tend to be of the general opinion that we get the vast majority of our sodium from ultra processed foods, prepackaged foods, let's say. Again, not always, not all of them, but that's where in the American diet, that's where we get the vast majority of our sodium is from ultra processed foods. Very little sodium intake, relatively speaking, comes from the salt shaker, so to speak. So, you know, if you have the occasional recipe that is high in sodium, but the vast majority of your diet is like minimally processed whole foods that you make at home, you know, my bet is that your blood pressure is okay, but ultimately what matters is that your blood pressure is okay. And I really am looking forward to in the next decade making at-home blood pressure readings even more accessible. You know, like we have continuous glucose monitors, et cetera. I think a continuous blood pressure cuff, not even continuous, but like we have a blood pressure cuff at home, and I recommend people buy a, you can get it on Amazon. It's not expensive. Get a blood pressure cuff. The problem is, it's like, I say the problem, I'm not saying it's an insurmountable problem, but like to get a good blood pressure reading, you're supposed to sit for 5 minutes. You should be at, you know, have your arm at chest height. You should be relaxed. You know, it's like all these stipulations. And again, with a two-year-old trying to run a business, and am I like, when am I having this like woo-saw, relaxed, you know, I just don't have that. So I still do it every single day, but I accept that, you know, there's going to be a little bit variability in that reading. So hopefully that was helpful. We're going to do one more. Last question. Oh, this is nice. No question, but 2016 J-Lips looks great. Thanks for posting some light and fun content during this heavy time. Yeah, I appreciate that. That is how I felt about it. At first, I was like, these 2016 things are stupid. Like, this isn't helpful content. And then I was like, dude, every time I go on this app, it's like, just insert. It's like Trump's taking Greenland, you know, ICE stuff, you know, there's like a lot of heavy stuff going on. And I was like, you know what, let's do a little reminisce. Let's just keep it light for one day. And then we'll get back to like fighting against misinformation and charlatans. And so I appreciate that. And it's funny, I was looking at those photos and I did think to my, I thought J-Lips, you know, 2016 was my best year, you know? But I don't look back again, like I said in the post, I don't look back on that with any bit of, I wish I was like that. I don't. That was a very different time with very different goals. And I'm super grateful for where I'm at right now. But yeah, sure, that was my most jacked and my most shredded. So cool. Appreciate that. I'll see you guys in the next episode. Have a good one. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.